Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. On this podcast, we talk about true crime in Indiana. We interview people who know specifics about the case and or are a part of the crime. Thank you all for joining me here at PopCon. With me today, I have Al Hunter, a local historian, and I'm very excited to bring you this episode. All right, well, let's get started. Everybody, I'm Joe Melillo, like I just said, and Al Hunter's here.
Thank you, Joe.
Al, give the crowd here at PopCon a little idea of who you are exactly.
I write for the Weekly View newspaper on the east side of Indianapolis, have for over a decade now. I've written several books, historical. But I suppose most people know me because I lead the ghost tours in Irvington and have for going on 20 years. So you call me a historian, I'm really a pop culturalist. So
part of this podcast, and you've been on my podcast, this is the third time.
In a row.
But the other one hasn't aired. I do stories about, for anybody who doesn't know, people or places that are based in Indiana and crimes that happen here. And then I go out and try to find the people who are very closely connected to them, if not a part of the crime itself. For example, today we will be talking about Jim Jones, the infamous pastor from Indianapolis, who was the head of the Jonestown Massacre. And then we'll also try to bring up the other guy who you know about.
Charles Manson.
So we're talking about some seriously bad dudes today.
And one more at the end of the podcast. Yeah, a surprise for Joe.
It's a surprise for me. So this, you know, the reason I do the podcast the way I do it is I find that sometimes other true crime podcasts, not naming names, just the genre in general, is very, very fear-mongered. The idea is to scare us to death so that we have this innate feeling to want to learn more and want to change it. Well, I went through that as a listener, but also as a former reporter and really a history buff. My goal is to let's get past all of that, because that's only temporary. The facts and stuff like that is only temporary for a little bit, but eventually, what's left behind are the people that were affected by this, and I think those people deserve a voice. So that's my goal, to get those people's voice out and also try to get down to the real story of it and learn exactly. And that's why I think we're friends.
Yeah.
Because you are, as you call yourself, a lowbrow historian.
Absolutely.
What does lowbrow historian mean? Because there's highbrow and then there's lowbrow.
We've had this discussion before, and lowbrow would be the things that everybody in this room would be doing right this second. Highbrow would be the things that you would see down at the IRT or the Symphony or at one of the universities. So it's one of them, I think, is incredibly interesting. The other is pretty boring.
Think lowbrow as in pop culture is perfect for it. You know, when you have the infamous pop culture history, Charles Manson. That's why we wanted to talk about it today. Charles Manson is a perfect person to talk about here at PopCon, because he was part of pop culture history when him and his clan of crazies killed those people. It became pop culture in a minute.
Yeah. People don't realize that he had a history here, and when you consider his lifespan before he was incarcerated, he spent about a third of his life here in Indianapolis, and most people don't realize that. Late 40s into the mid-50s, he was here.
And remind people, he was here when he was a teenager.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he was here when he was older, and he did come back. Didn't he come back twice?
He did. And this was what he considered home. He never really had a home. He had led a transient lifestyle. He himself said that his mother was a prostitute. He himself remembered that his mother traded him for a bottle of wine one time. She was not much of a mother. Her mother lived here in Indianapolis, very, very close to the old Central State Hospital on Exeter Ave. And that's where he ended up. He started out, they put his parents couldn't raise him. His mother couldn't raise him, so she sent him to the Gabalt School for Boys in Terre Haute, which was basically a reform school. He ran away from there, lived under bridges, lived in alleys. He made his way to Indianapolis. He broke into a little store, and in this store was a cigar box full of money. It was $100, more money than he had ever seen. Keep in mind, this is the mid-40s. That's a lot of money. He took this money and he rented a little apartment, a little house over near Central State. And he tried to go straight. He tried to first start as a Western Union delivery boy, but then he quickly started breaking into cars, and the money ran out. He was partying, and people were wondering, what is this teenager renting a place? Where's he getting this money? So they threw him into the boys' school in Plainfield. And, of course, he recalled at the Gabalt School in Terre Haute that he had been attacked in every way possible. And when he went to Plainfield, he reversed that. He was a very diminutive young guy, but he reversed that, and he started to become the pursuer. He started to become the attacker.
Were there documented moments where he was abused?
Absolutely, and abused in every way you can think of.
And here in Indiana, too.
In Indianapolis,
these things happen here in the state.
Yeah. His was institutionalized abuse. His abuse came from his family, his mother, because she didn't care. So who knows what happened to him in that scenario. But most of the really bad things that formed his personality took place while he was incarcerated, while he was held and could not be released on his own recognizance.
These reformatory schools, he went to multiple, two in Indiana, and then Boys Town in Kansas.
He conned his way into that in 1949.
So there seems to be a theme here with that.
Yeah, I mean, he was a con man from a very young age. A pastor came in, a priest came in, saw him, thought he had potential, and nominated him to be sent out to Father Flanagan's Boys Town. He went out, said, "I want to be a good boy, and I want to break the bondage of my mother, of my prostitute mother." And made the front page of the Indianapolis Star as this clean-cut kid. And they sent him out there, and within just a few days, he escaped. And pretty much, he headed back to Indianapolis, was here for probably up until about 54, 55, headed out to West Virginia, and then he certainly came back to Indianapolis after that, because this was the only place that he knew as home until he went out to California.
You know, I guess when we look back on where he kind of went wrong, he started getting into drugs, and obviously the past played a huge factor in the way his mind operated, so adding the drug factor to it and then the cult-like attitude to add people behind him, you know, I guess drugs are bad.
Well, to say that he started getting into drugs might be a bit of a misnomer. He realized early what drugs could do. And most often, although the people around him, he was dosing with high doses of drugs, he himself was not partaking. Same thing with alcohol. He would feed you alcohol and he would be drinking non-alcohol because it's a control thing. Drugs were a way for him to gain control.
See, I never knew that. I always thought that he had the drug problem himself and then just added people with him.
No.
So again, we're talking about Charles Manson for anybody who's stepping up. Charles Manson recently passed away. Some of his associates have just been denied parole out in California. So, you know, that story still has some sort of continuation, but it's basically over. And if you look on the Indy Star and you go to the newspaper here in Indy, you will see Charles Manson as this little boy, this 16-year-old boy, who is propped up as someone who wants to reform and wants to change, only go to Boys Town and then escape and then continue on his rampage.
Yeah.
Where did he live in Indianapolis? So people, when you drive by, you could say, oh, I heard that Charles Manson lived here or near here.
On Exeter Ave, which is not far from Warman Avenue, very near the, if you're standing at the Indiana Medical History Museum, you can almost see the street that he lived on.
Is that the Central State Hospital?
Yes.
So near the campus of Central State Hospital on the west side.
And he, there is no question in my mind, Central State was an operating insane asylum, an institution at the time. So there's no question that he realized that was part of his gig, part of his shtick, was that he ran into heavily medicated people. Central State had a playground on Warman Avenue that they would let their internees go and spend the day. Well, Manson would go over there and talk with these patients, some heavily medicated, some with bringing along their own mental problems. And that's how he learned to play these mind control games. And he saw very easily what medication would do to people. That happened to him when he was a teenager. And he took all that he learned. That's what he went out to California and he used it. And he figured out this works.
This part of this train, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit more. Funny story, really quick. My wife and I got married at Central State Hospital. So it shows you where my mind's at. No, we actually didn't know. It was a beautiful venue, and they've redone it since. And obviously, the Medical History Museum is there. But just to think that right down the street or right on the grounds where we were, he's walking around trying to grab people, trying to tell them, you know, these kind of men are throughout history. It's something that we run into on a regular.
Yeah, and it's not just Charlie Manson. It's also the guy we're going to talk about here in a minute.
So this is a good transition, I think. So I love Al, because Al finds out things that I can't find out. That hence why I'm not an expert and he's the expert that I brought on the podcast. But you will try to find a connection, and you're going to do it one day, I know, but I'm just going to say it, and you correct me how I'm wrong, that Charles Manson and Jim Jones, Pastor Reverend Jim Jones, could have been recruiting at the Central State Hospital at the same time. They may have even ran into each other.
Exactly.
Doesn't that give you chills? I mean, it's just freaky.
Yeah, they were here for a short time. They would have overlapped. And keep in mind, Jim Jones was an invited guest. Charles Manson was an intruder.
Yeah. So, different tactics, different styles. Jim Jones, in 1978, in September 1978, he murdered and convinced people to drink cyanide and Flavor-Aid, not Kool-Aid. Many people believe it's Kool-Aid, which is where the saying comes from, don't drink the Kool-Aid. I hear people say that all the time. And it's so funny, I was doing this episode, I have a full episode where I talked to Jim Jones's son, his adopted son, Jimmy Jones Jr. He lives in California now, he's much older, he has kids of his own, he loves basketball, he was born here in Indiana, and he was adopted as a baby by the Joneses, Marceline and Jim, and he was the last piece of their rainbow family. They had a different genetics and different nationalities, and they wanted to create this rainbow family here in Indianapolis because he believed so deeply that everyone needed to be treated equally that he created this family. And Jimmy Jones Jr. was the last child to be adopted, and he was the first African-American child to ever be adopted by a white family here in the state of Indiana. I mean, that's incredible.
Well, people forget, and maybe they should. They, you know, the ending of Jones kind of trumps everything he did before. But there, like a lot of these maniacs that you and I seem to talk about or find ourselves exploring together, like H.H. Holmes, they could have. There was a time where had they gone in a legitimate direction, they would have been millionaires, they would have been well respected. And Jim Jones was that way too. Jim Jones led the segregation fight in Indianapolis. People forget that. It was Jones who is responsible for getting rid of the blacks only, whites only drinking fountains.
In Indianapolis. The Midwest, of all places, really close to the heartland of civil rights activism, north, and then obviously the other way south.
Yeah, and it took place over about a 10-year period. And, you know, I was born and raised in Indianapolis, so I remember Jim Jones from his appearances on TV as a legitimate civil rights leader. And I can remember vividly that about the time just before he left for San Francisco, someone had planted a stick of dynamite in his coal pile because people were still heating their homes with coal. So had conceivably he shoveled that dynamite into his home, it would have blown up his house. That's what I remember seeing it on TV.
Again, if he died in 1955, right before he went over to San Francisco, well, he went over later, but yeah. If he had died in 1955, there would be streets named after him, there would be statues of him because he was such a civil rights leader. There's a story that I tell that he refused treatment at the hospital until it was desegregated. Yeah. He stood his ground, he stood up for all the lower-end communities. I kind of want to go back just a little bit because on my podcast, I don't get to speak about these specific details, but originally, he is from Richmond, technically born in Lynn, Indiana.
Technically born in Crete, Indiana.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But Lynn is like the biggest, and then it goes to Richmond. He lived in Lynn with his father's family, Old Jim, they used to call him, and he was a World War I vet. And he had post-traumatic stress syndrome
suffered
disorder.
From a gas attack.
Yep. And people thought he was just a drunk when he would walk down the street, but he wasn't. His father was basically having mental breakdowns and had no way. Meanwhile,
what we would call PTSD now.
That's right. And eventually, he would go down to the bar and the pool hall and left young Jim at home with his mom. His mom had to work double shift. Luckily, the family's took care of them somewhat, but they never really got along with Jim Jones's mother, Old Jim's wife. And that kind of led Jim to go seek other father figures, one of which was someone who was really into church and was a pastor. And eventually, that inspired him to start preaching. There's also stories about eventually his mother moved them both, him without his father, to Richmond, Indiana, where he went to his junior and senior year in high school. And there's stories about homecoming that he hosted a funeral. Jim Jones, imagine this, a teenager Jim Jones hosting a funeral at the homecoming event for his football team, and he was hosting the funeral for the rival football team, essentially a fake funeral.
Well, as a kid, he used to host funerals for the dead animals, the dead pets. And when he didn't have pets dying naturally, he dispatched a few of them himself just so that he could have funerals.
If that's not a sign of a serial killer, I don't know what is.
Yeah, textbook.
It's textbook. We know so much now about that kind of stuff that we can look back on where he went and how he got there. Something I found interesting, there were things called the tent circuit. It was the... Try to help me out here. What is it?
Well, it's barnstorming evangelists.
Evangelism. Yeah. It's the tent evangelist.
Which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a traveling circus populated by evangelists.
Yep. And he used to travel around, and he would go, what Jim Jones was really known for were his so-called miracles, that he was God himself. Eventually, everyone called him Father, which is creepy and also true. But everybody called him Father, and that was when he had the cult, and he was the leader, and all this stuff, and he did do a lot of drugs, unlike Charles Manson, but he was doing a lot of drugs. But that was in the 60s and 70s.
Which made him paranoid.
Right, right. But when he was an evangelist and going around these tent circuit in Indiana, he would charge his wife to go out in the crowd, like if we were here right now, and kind of walk around, and he was so good at reading people, he would pick his victims out of the crowd, tell his wife, go stand behind that guy and listen to what that guy is saying, and tell me something that I can use so I can look like I can read his mind. And sure enough, it worked. And that was only one trick. Do you remember any more? I have one more that I remember, but what's another trick he used to pull?
The chicken liver thing.
Well,
was
that's
the big
one.
Thing.
Yeah, I love that one.
Yeah, the
Go
chicken
ahead,
liver
tell that
thing.
One.
But I'll let you tell it. But it's interesting. It's gory and it's pure you. But I do remember speaking with people. I lead tours in Irvington, and Irvington is the former home to Butler College. So you have a supposed higher class of people there. And in Irvington, when you radiate out, the pastors and the preachers didn't like Jim Jones for one specific reason, because he would ask to come to speak at their church, and he would speak for free, but he was really there to steal their parishioners. He'd take them five or six or seven at a time, and of course other pastors don't like that. He would go in and he would focus on the minority population, which was, Indianapolis was segregated at that time. So he would say, come to my church, brother, come to my church, sister, I'll treat you like a human being. And he would glean off these people who became some of his most devoted followers, and some of those died in the jungles of Guyana with him.
Jim Jones took a lot of Indianapolis families with him to Guyana and Jonestown. And that's where they did die.
But now you got to tell the chicken liver story.
Yeah. So the chicken liver story is great. It's insane. But he would essentially charge one of his higher ups, his officers, to pretend like they were sick or pretend they had cancer, and then he would go up to them and heal them. In the meantime, they would begin to cough and cough and cough, and when they coughed, one time they would cough up what looked to be a tumor, and it would be bloody and gross, and people wouldn't, you know, you kind of close one eye looking at it, and the truth was, it was just a trick. It was just a chicken liver or chicken heart, and he had it, and it was a sleight of hand trick, and he was like literally a magician.
Yeah, and you're forgetting one of the aspects that makes Jim just that much, it raises the ick factor on Jim Jones. In the 50s when he was here, he used to sell monkeys door to door.
Oh, yeah.
And people don't believe that, but there's a very famous picture of him. He'd sold them for $29 a piece. He purchased them from India, had them imported, and would go knock on your door. And I have talked to people that remember him coming and knocking on their door to sell them a little chimpanzee or a spider monkey.
One of my the first Jim Jones, there's two parts on the Infamous Indie podcast, and the first one I talked to a former parishioner who talks about that moment. He also talks about how much anger he had. He turned beet red during his sermons at his church. And by the way, so far I've told you one place to go visit, which is Central State Hospital, where you can see we're possibly right down the street from where Charles Manson lived. I'm going to tell you another location that's for certain. There are many, many churches where Jim Jones preached at in Indianapolis, but the People's Temple Church was the church that he started and then continued in California and then down in Guyana. So the People's Temple is on 14th and New Jersey. And that is the first church that he owned and was the pastor.
And the Manson House is on New Jersey and Exeter, so yeah. They're not far apart.
No.
It's all intertwined.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it really is.
I find that Indiana is the crossroads of America because of the fact there's like 6 degrees of separation for stuff like this. Not in Indiana, there's like two. Like, everything has a connection, and everybody knows everybody. And talk about a small town feel with a big town atmosphere. That's what this is with true crime in everything I do.
Well, Indiana, a lot of these connections stem from Union Station, which was the only Union Station in the world when it was in operation. Everybody had to come through. All roads led to Indiana. And the people that you are at the convention center right now, and the list of people that were walking these grounds would amaze you. You would have no earthly idea that they were ever here. Thomas Edison used to work at Union Station, hung out here. This was, obviously the convention center was not here at the time, but Edison was here.
Right here.
Right here, right here.
There you go, Thomas Edison, folks. So who's dressed up as Thomas Edison?
Edison, John Muir, Muir Woods, worked very close to here. John Wilkes Booth.
Who's that?
Used to appear here, and people remember that in his early days he came here and he got universally panned. They talked about what an awful actor John Wilkes Booth was, but how handsome he was and how they couldn't take your eyes off of him. Abraham Lincoln came through here twice, once alive and once dead.
I love that story.
Yeah.
You, listen, and if you want to know more about the less crime, more history, but Al's history, you got to take his Irvington Ghost Tour every October on the weekends, and you will learn so much. I'm going to tell this story because I love it so much, but you have a ring that you bring with you on these tours, and at one spot we stand in Irvington, and you go around the circle, and you tell everybody, put this ring on, put this ring on, put this
especially
ring on.
Little kids.
Yeah. So you have this ring on, and you're thinking, Al, what the heck is this? And you'll tell us the story about how that ring was the guard's, possibly the guard's ring, who guarded Lincoln's body at the Indiana State House that night he was here in Indiana, the funeral train as it came through. They had to store his body or keep his body on laying in state at the State House. And the guard that was on duty, and I love the line that you say, if you were the guard watching over Lincoln's body, wouldn't you just go up and touch it? Just kind of brush him off, fix his collar. Yeah. And absolutely, that's exactly what I would do.
Everybody would.
I think we should go back in time.
Everybody would. Yeah, that's Colonel W.W. Freiberger. He was in charge of Lincoln's body. And it's his regimental ring, so it was on it was on his finger when he's watching over Lincoln. But that list continued. I mean, Ray Charles was busted for heroin. Just a couple blocks from here.
Mike Tyson.
Mike Tyson was here.
Of a crime.
More importantly, right on the exact spot, there are two important people on this very spot that would ring a bell with crime buffs. One is Handsome Harry Pierpont, John Dillinger's cohort. And in fact, Pierpont was considered to be the leader of the gang. But Dillinger took it over, and Pierpont didn't mind because he knew that Dillinger would get the heat when he would get away, and that's what he did. He died in the electric chair, but still, he didn't die in an alley in Chicago like Dillinger. He lived right here in a house where this convention center now stands. But most importantly, another tenement house has a connection from Brooklyn to Indianapolis.
Oh, is this a surprise for
me? This is your surprise.
Al does this to me all the time. He will give people surprises he cares about, and it's funny because there's surprises about history and things that he finds out, and I love it because there's always something. You took us to
Hoag's Run.
Run. That was a great was a great trip.
It's not a special. Anybody can do it. You just have to have an interest. Anybody can do it.
So Brooklyn and Indiana are connected. Officially, by the way, I'm from New York and Connecticut. I grew up on the East Coast. For the last 10 years, I've been a reporter traveling our country, living in different spots while I worked as a reporter. And then I made it to Wish TV here in Indianapolis. I'm still technically on Wish TV with a new segment called Joe on the Go. So you can check that out on Wish TV and wishtv.com. But the reporter in me, that's what kind of got this podcast going. And I lived in Brooklyn for a little bit too. So, okay, I'm ready.
Well, on this spot.
Bring it to me.
And most Hoosiers don't know this. On this spot, this was kind of the low rent district of Indianapolis. It was swampy. It was mosquito ridden. Lots of tenement houses here. And in one of these tenement houses, I would propose that a William H. Bonney was born. You would know William H. Bonney better as Billy the Kid.
No way.
Billy the Kid was born in 1859. His mother came into this country and came in through Brooklyn. She lived in Brooklyn for a while in the late 1850s. Nobody knows. There's no birth certificate for Billy the Kid. But there, in the census, Billy the Kid appears in the census, the Indianapolis census, in about 1861. 1862. He's born in 1859, and he's here until about 1868 when he goes out to New Mexico. Remember, he died at the age of 21. So if you do the math, and if you could possibly prove that he was born here, you can't. It's easily provable that he lived here. He would have spent half his life right here where the convention center now stands, on the very spot.
Billy the Kid.
Billy the Kid. And what makes Billy the Kid even more amazing is he never robbed anyone. He wasn't a bank robber. People think, you know, Wild West, what did you do? He didn't really commit any crimes if you go from the perspective of self-defense. There was the old legend that he killed 21 men, a man for every year of his life. Well, one of those was a deputy sheriff named Bill Allinger, I think his name, or Bud Allinger, I'm not sure what his name was, but he's the one that he killed with the shotgun full of silver dimes. So those are the crimes that he's guilty of. He never robbed anybody, and yet he's one of the most well-known Wild West heroes, Billy the Kid, and he came out of Indianapolis, right where you all are sitting.
So there you go. Anybody dressed as Billy the Kid? Nope, I didn't think so. I think we're moving along here. I'd like to possibly wrap this up. I mean, 40 minutes. My podcast, usually the interviews take about 40
minutes.
Yeah,
ours always go long.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you think these folks would be interested in?
I always, when we talk, I always try and tell you to make sure that you don't miss the history that's right in front of you. There are all sorts of history. History is what you want it to be. It's all around you, and it's easily mistaken as part of life. But in truth, it's history's going on, and what you're doing here, what you do on your day-to-day is going to be part of your own personal history, but you'll also be able to be part of bigger history, stories that your children and your grandchildren are going to talk about down the road. And I speak to people all the time that have been at important events, and they don't realize it. They didn't take any pictures. They don't have any accounts. My favorite comes from a Hoosier by the name of John Hay, who was Abraham Lincoln's personal secretary, and I've said this before. He was from Salem, Indiana. John Hay was in the Lincoln White House the entire 5 years and traveled with Lincoln. He traveled to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania in November of 1863. He was there when Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address.
Four score and seven years ago.
He missed that speech because he was in the taverns. He's a young man. He's in the taverns drinking, trying to collect votes for Abraham Lincoln. So he missed the speech, and that was the one regret of his life, was missing that speech. That was the history that's right in front of you. You need to make sure, get yourself in that place at that time, because it only shows up once.
I love it. And that's such a good lesson to learn. And we try, you know, you and I, the last three episodes, have really tried to make sure we hit on the, where can we fix some of these issues. I heard the other day, my beautiful wife told me, she said, yes, I see you. She said, we have to make sure that nowadays, or she heard that nowadays, that we need to be real. Like, realness, it resonates now more than ever before. And you, it's funny, you say lowbrow history and versus highbrow. For so long, you got to think highbrow is like almost like we want to just forget the bad stuff. No, everybody's fine. No one's got any problems. We're all okay. When the truth of the matter is, everyone's got issues. Everyone's got problems. It's just how we handle them. And if we face them like men and women, then we'll be able to maybe stop some of these crazies that take over and be honest with each other and with ourselves. Yeah. It's okay. We're all messed up. It's just a matter of in what degree. Sorry. Al, I don't know about you, but...
Yeah, I'm a little messed up in area. You can ask my wife.
So I guess the big lesson and what you'll hear on the podcast again is when you listen in, I'd really appreciate any feedback on if you learn something or hear something that's interesting to you, please message me or tell me.
Or have anything to add.
Yeah, if you have something that piques your interest. I mean, someone wrote on my Facebook Live that we're doing that... Hey, what about the Burger Chef murders?
Yeah. Well, I'm wearing the shirt.
So yeah, I know. Look at him.
I'm wearing the shirt. But that happens. It's going to happen on your podcast. It's happened in my newspaper articles. I wrote an article about Elvis Presley coming through Indianapolis as a young, budding star, and he had a flat tire not far from Irvington, pulled into a gas station.
It's like Forrest Gump, yeah. Like stuff. Like he's like, oh, he had a flat tire, and
he played
to pay for his...
But this, you know, he pulled into a gas station, got his tire fixed, and moved on. It's not that big a deal, but it was Elvis Presley. Well, I wrote that article, and about a week later, I got an email from a girl saying, I'm glad that you said that, because my dad gave me a set of lug nuts when I was a kid and said these came off of Elvis's car, and
that's
I did not believe him, and now I know it's true.
Wow.
That's history. That's the way it works.
So be on the lookout for history in front of you. Everybody, if you'd like to listen to the Infamous Indie podcast, you can do it on Apple, Stitcher, Radio Public, and Spotify. Please follow me on Facebook at Infamous Indie Podcast with Joe Melillo on Facebook. And then on Instagram, it's Infamous Indie Pod on Instagram. I update as much as I can, and I'd love to hear any feedback. And I'm honored to be here, Brad, because yesterday I was awarded the Best True Crime Podcast in the PopCon Awards. And then I was also honored with the award for Best Overall Podcast for the PopCon Awards.
And you're up for an Emmy, aren't you?
I'm up for an Emmy as well. Next week I find out if my 2018 career TV year wins for live reporting for an Emmy. So I could have some two really big door holders or door stops coming up soon.
Better just make room.
Just put the Emmys, right? Paperweight. So thank you, everybody, for joining me and Al. Trying to see where the plug-in. I was going to play the end of the... Let's see if we can do it. Where is it? I lost it. We're going to play the music to end it because I love the music. Thank you. And again, if you guys have any crimes that we know of or that you know that we didn't talk about so far, just to recap, by the way, we talked about H.H. Holmes. Yeah, we did. We talked about H.H. Holmes, Charles Manson, Billy the Kid, who else? Jim Jones, Abraham Lincoln, John Wilkes Booth.
Thomas Edison.
And I don't see even Abraham Lincoln's. That would be really cool. I think you should dress up like him next time.
But did you tell him that last week you were hanging out with H.H. Holmes' great-great-grandson?
I didn't tell you that, yeah. H.H. Holmes' great-great-grandson was here. He's trying to prove if he's Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, isn't that fun?
You guys got to look it up. Anyway, so, Al, you're one of my good friends, man.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
We better take a break. People are going to get tired of hearing my voice. You better find somebody else.
I got to find at least a couple more episodes where you're not in it. Because, you know, you're just too good, though. You're too good, so.
Yeah, tell my wife.
She probably hears you a lot. I always say at the end of every podcast, because it's important, thanks for joining me, and stay safe.